Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. You know, at the end of the 19th century and into the early 20th century, William Randolph Hearst basically invented modern journalism. He was the Rupert Murdoch and Ted Turner of his time, rolled into one and then some. My guest today, Stephen Ives, is the director of an upcoming biographical film about his life. The PBS program Citizen Hearst will air on American Experience Monday and Tuesday, September 27th and 28th, from 9 to 11 p.m. on Eastern Time. Welcome, Stephen.
Well, thanks, Court. Good to be with you.
Nice to have you on. You know, so Ted Turner's father owned a big billboard company in Georgia, several different cities in Georgia, and he died when Turner was like in his early 20s, so Turner inherited that thing all of a sudden. And it wasn't TV, but it was media, and it was money, and he could build on it, which he obviously did. So how did Hearst get started?
William Randolph Hearst's father, George, was a Wild West mining engineer, and he had an innate ability to see the land and understand what was beneath it. And he went boom and bust many times, starting in the gold rush. But he ended up striking it rich at the Comstock Lode in Nevada and the Homestead Mine in South Dakota, and he became an immensely wealthy man. When he died, he left it all, strikingly, to his wife, Phoebe, not to his young son. But it was a tremendous amount of money. It was $15 to $20 million, and we're talking 1891. So was a gigantic boost for anybody looking to break out and start their own business.
So, yeah, it sounds like he had the Midas touch. I mean, a lot of people went to California during the gold rush and struck out, but he kept striking rich. And everything he did worked out great for him. And as you say, he built up a massive fortune, which then Hearst didn't inherit, but had indirect access to through his mother. So were there any early indications that William Randolph Hearst would become the business and media titan that he later became?
He wasn't a very good student. He flunked out of Harvard, so you wouldn't have had a huge amount of confidence in him as a young man. But while he was at Harvard, he took over the Harvard Lampoon, which was the humor magazine for the student body. And it had been failing and losing money, and he figured out a way to sell advertising very effectively and put it in the black. So early on, he got a sense that he could make money off of print media and that he had an innate knack for it. And that was something he rode for the rest of his career.
Might have inherited that gene from his dad. So, you know, it'd be interesting as a side thought to see what percentage of people who drop out of or are kicked out of Harvard become successful compared to those who graduate from Harvard and become successful.
I'm not sure. I don't think Bill Gates ever graduated, for example.
Yeah, I know. A lot of people like that just kind of catch fire and say, what do I need college for? But, you know, he did, as we said, you know, grow up privileged and pampered. So a lot of times people in that mode, you know, born with a big silver spoon in their mouth, never take it out, right? So what do you think drove him as maniacally as it did? You know?
He could have been it's an interesting question, Court. He could have been a ne'er-do-well. He could have lived this sort of feckless life. But he was tremendously driven. And I don't think it was so much insecurity, although I can imagine why he might have felt insecure. His father was distant, away a lot of the time, not a particularly warm person, didn't give him a lot of love, and didn't trust him enough to leave any money to him when he died. They pampered him, but they also made him feel like he was special. Phoebe gave him a tremendous amount of attention, and he had a tremendous ego and a desire for power. And he followed that relentlessly for the entire length of his career. And it's really remarkable what he manages to do. But it's not one of those classic stories where he's trying to make up for some horrible slight or some insecurity in his psyche, I don't think. I think he just was born with a desire to achieve, and he found the niche that helped him follow that path.
Yeah, it sounds like he was born, you know, smart and with a lot of drive, and then he was an only child, right? So his mother's pampering of him. And I think, you know, we're going to find out later in the show, she was a pretty tough broad, to use an old term. She controlled him and steered him in ways that were in the end productive to him, I think. But would his first paper have succeeded without his father's financial backing? And where did he get going? What was his first paper?
Well, it might have. I mean, George Hearst, like a lot of rich Westerners, decided he wanted to be a senator. And to do that in his era, you simply bought a newspaper and turned it into your own personal promotional vehicle. So he bought a little rag called the San Francisco Examiner, which was a lowly paper in San Francisco that had no real readership and was dwarfed by the Chronicle and the Call, which were these illustrious newspapers with huge, fancy, you know, headquarters. But it got him into the Senate, and then it was just languishing. And Will convinced his father to give it to him, and he turned it around. It's, you know, he was a natural innovator. He brought a tremendous amount of interesting new things to the paper. Bold use of color, wild, big, bold headlines, sensational reporting, all the things that Joseph Pulitzer was already beginning to do in New York on the other side of the continent. But he also raided all the opposing papers and stole their best editors, best artists, best reporters. And he couldn't have done that without an endless pool of money from his father. So he had the natural gift, but that huge war chest certainly didn't hurt.
Yeah, again, like Ted Turner, I mean, if you've got the talent and the drive, sometimes that isn't enough. But if you've got millions of dollars behind you, it can easily be enough. And so,
yeah.
So, you know, you talked about the innovations he brought, which are all, at the time, I think were viewed as kind of lurid disruptions of journalism. Would you say that he kind of early on invented the tabloid?
In some ways, no, because we think of tabloids now as being just the kind of sensational, lurid reporting that Hearst was known for. But tabloids in the 20s were a very specific thing. They were even smaller than his papers. They were heavily based on photography. And they were even, if conceivably possible, they were even less substantive than some of Hearst's papers. And he kind of hated the tabloids, actually. He felt they were tacky, they were poorly printed. And for all of Hearst's willingness to wallow in the gutter of journalism at times, he loved good writing. He cared about good writing, and he cared about good reporting. And he just felt the tabloids were tacky, and he didn't want to have anything to do with them. But they started to eat into his working class readers in New York. And he ultimately had to create one called the New York Mirror and try and compete. Time magazine said, you know, that the terrible tabloids have out-Hearsted Hearst. And for the first time, he was sort of getting a dose of his own medicine. And by that time, he was older and wasn't really able to adapt. And he wasn't the brash young innovator that he had been. And they kind of ate his lunch a little bit.
So maybe one difference is that, and I'll ask it as a question, did the reporting in his papers always stick to the truth? Even if they may have exaggerated things, were they basically real reporting in that they were factual?
I don't think Hearst's papers ever let the truth get in the way of a good story, frankly. They were wildly sensational. They would make things up. They would distort things in any way that they felt would help them get readers. And you see this in particular in the reporting leading up to the Spanish-American War, where the competition that Hearst is going through with Joseph Pulitzer is so extreme that he's literally fabricating entire narratives and horrific atrocities committed by the horrible Spaniards against the poor, defenseless Cubans. And it's just fake news to the nth degree. And yet it's immensely successful. I mean, his circulation skyrockets, and that's exactly what he was doing. And he knew what he was doing from the very beginning.
Well, it sounds like a fine line between that and tabloids to me.
It's not a difference.
It's on the spectrum.
It is. It was mostly just that the tabloids were a function of the 20s and the function of this commuter class that was now reading these things. If you look at the tabloids compared to Hearst's papers, they are different. I mean, the tabloids are sort of from the Onion, headless man found in topless bar. You know, that was the kind of thing that the tabloids reveled in.
Yeah, okay. What was he like to work for? I mean, I've seen your film, and I know the answer, but what kind of a boss was he compared to the average newspaper owner?
From what I can tell, he was great fun to work for. He paid his people extremely well. He didn't care if they were reckless or drunkards or out all night, as long as they got the story. He was a brash innovator and always doing new things. It was never dull in a Hearst newsroom. And as he gets older in his life, he becomes very much a kind of reactionary guy, and his trust-busting pro-union stance changes, and he becomes much more opposed to unions, and in particular to the idea that the people that work for his newspapers would have the gall to actually unionize. And so he's not, he's a tougher and less tolerant, much more corporate employer near the end of his life. But that's because he's running a massive media empire at that point.
You know, so I also saw that he was very, in his style of work, all the way into late middle age anyway, he was very hands-on. I mean, he was obsessive about the layout of the paper. He didn't just leave it to other people to do. I mean, he would come in and basically do the work of an editor, even when he was a multimillionaire owner of several papers, right?
Yeah, and I think that's what's really interesting about Hearst. He, you know, it wouldn't be uncommon for him to come in and look at the paper in the afternoon and then go out for a fancy dinner in full evening dress, sometimes with two chorus girls, one on each arm, and then come back at 11:30, 12, and begin rearranging the front page of the paper in time for the deadline. He was intensely focused on every single aspect of his papers, and that's one of the reasons that they were so successful. Yeah. He said, I want to create a paper for me, and he knew what he wanted, and he knew what he was interested in, and that also had a tremendous resonance with his working-class readers.
Yeah. I mean, he knew what he wanted and he knew what they wanted, and to some extent they overlapped.
Indeed.
And,
yeah.
And he probably got the respect of his staff by doing that. I mean, they were probably scared of him a little bit, and they saw how talented he was, and they saw how focused he was on his work, and I suspect that kept their noses to the grindstone as well, I would think. You know,
It did, and also, don't forget, sometimes he would double their salaries to bring them, lure them away from a competitive paper. So they were really happy to be working for a Hearst newspaper.
a rich, fun guy. He couldn't beat it.
Okay. Exactly.
But apart from that, he was a serious racist, so talk about that aspect of him.
Well, I mean, Hearst was a Democrat from California. His father had been a Democrat and a central platform of the Democratic Party at that time. We're talking at the 1880s, was anti-Asian racism. I mean, the Chinese Exclusion Act had been passed in the 1880s. Chinese were seen as invading even early on in the gold fields, where they were regularly discriminated against and sometimes violently attacked. And it was a vicious and very lurid kind of racist portrayal that was extremely common and extremely popular. And Hearst milked it and used it to stir up his readership and cater to the white working class, who felt most threatened by Chinese laborers who had come from the gold fields, then worked on the railroads, and were an increasing fact of life in places like San Francisco. So, yeah, it was an undeniable part of Hearst's early career.
Mm-hmm. You know, we mentioned his mom, Phoebe, who had a powerful influence on his personal and professional life. And I think I said that, you know, it was probably good for him. Would you agree with that? You know, was she a positive factor in his life, even though she held the purse strings until it must have driven him crazy?
Yeah, I mean, that was what was so complicated about his relationship with his mother. They were extremely close, but it was humiliating for this grown man who was running his own business to have to go and beg for a loan from his mommy, and he had to do it over and over again. And she never denied him, ultimately, the money he needed for big acquisitions, to buy new papers, to live an extremely lavish opulent lifestyle. But she also worried about him. She worried about his overspending. She worried about how leveraged he was. She would regularly tell him he had to be more responsible. They were running out of money, even though they really weren't. So it was a deeply conflicted, I think, and complicated relationship. And I think when Hearst didn't get the inheritance from his father, that had to sting. I mean, that had to be a really tough blow. And to be tethered to your mother into your middle age had to be painful and difficult. But in the end, when Phoebe died of the Spanish flu in 1919, ironically enough, he said, I've always been a bit of a mama's boy, and I'm mighty glad of it.
Yeah. Yeah, I was going to say that. He sounds like he was the world's biggest mama's boy, but... You know, what struck me in looking at your film is that he was so successful in his papers, but he kept needing to borrow more money, You would have thought he was rolling in money from the papers, but I guess part of the thing was that he kept acquiring new papers rather than just resting on his laurels, and that's part of his whole approach to life and his whole mystique, I guess. But
yeah, I mean, he was always leveraging himself, always in debt, always growing and expanding recklessly at any cost. So no matter how much money he had, it was never enough. And what he didn't spend on his papers, he spent wildly on his own lifestyle.
Partying.
Yeah.
You're listening to American Variety Radio. We're partying here with Stephen Ives, who is the director of a biographical film about publisher William Randolph Hearst. And Stephen's in Manhattan, so you might hear in the background some time to time the sound of sirens and the various noises that Manhattan always makes, right?
Yep.
So speaking of New York, in 1895, I think it was, Hearst went to New York with the ambition, you know, from San Francisco to expand into that market, which was a very big ambition to have because it was the biggest market. But it was already a closed world of wealth and power, you know, and had been for, you know, well over a century at that time. How did he manage to break in to that crust?
Well, he wanted to break into the market. He wanted to take on the big enchilada, you know, Joseph Pulitzer, who was the king of American journalism at that time. But he didn't really care about breaking into New York society. He could have bought a townhouse on Fifth Avenue. He could have joined all the right clubs. And he had no interest in that. He was an outsider and always cultivated a kind of an outsider's perspective and an outsider's view. He was from California. He was kind of a cowboy. And he cared more about what you did rather than who you were in terms of pedigree. Mm. But when he got there, the newspaper market was overstocked. There were dozens of papers catering to every conceivable audience, from Yiddish papers to Italian papers to papers in Polish and Chinese. And he bought something called the Morning Journal, which was a totally bankrupt little rag that had no readers to speak of. And he rolled up his sleeves and everyone scoffed at him and thought he'd be a rich man's son who couldn't possibly do anything with it. And he basically did what he did in San Francisco again, but on steroids. And he just took Pulitzer on relentlessly. And that newspaper war was what led to what was known as yellow journalism, and was a bare-knuckled brawl on the pages of these papers, the Journal and Pulitzer's paper, The World.
Yes, yeah, so he was, I guess, what would be today called in corporate world a turnaround specialist. He would buy little cheap things at a discount and then through his own skill and ambition and energy build them up. But he went after, as you say, Pulitzer's market, when Pulitzer had a paper called The World, which kind of had a stranglehold on the working class in New York, rather than going after the New York Times' more well-heeled market. So I think it's obvious that that was the right strategy at the time. Did he agonize over that, or was it obvious to him?
I don't think he ever gave it a second thought, actually. I think there was a fork in the road. I mean, the Times was catering to a very upscale audience and was very proud of its sort of sober, dull writing. And Hearst, his sympathy, his interest was always with the working man. And New York was teeming with immigrants at this point in the turn of the century. And he knew how to cater to them. He knew how to speak their language. And he knew how to undercut Pulitzer's advantage. And I don't think he would have ever considered, in the same way that he was an outsider in New York socially, I don't think he would have had any interest in sort of catering to the rich market that the Times was going after and hoping to make money out of advertising. He made money out of circulation, pure and simple. And that's what drove him, and that's what drove his reporting and his wild innovation and sort of often cavalier relationship to the truth.
So, yeah, was that support he had for the working classes? You know, here's a guy, a rich guy from Harvard, right? I mean, he had what was called advocacy journalism, or I guess today we would call that by that name. Was it sincere, or was it just good business because there were a whole lot more people in the working class than there were in the upper class?
I think that gets to the central question and contradiction of Hearst, in my view. Was he a true progressive, kind of railing against the trusts that dominated the big cities and kept the masses living in poverty, the ICE Trust and the Gas Trust in New York, backed up by the political machine that was called Tammany Hall. Mm. Did he really believe that? I think in some ways he did. He saw the world in terms of melodrama, heroes and villains, and he just hated villains. He liked to go after bad guys. But at the same time, he knew better than anyone that that was an immensely successful marketing and business strategy. And more readers meant more followers, meant more power. And he was focused on that exclusively, I think, throughout his career. So it's an interesting duality in his career and in his psyche.
Mm-hmm. Well, I noticed at one point, I mean, there were kids called Newsies. And when I say kids, I mean kids who passed out the newspapers on the street because there was no other distribution mechanism for them, really. And they would actually buy the newspapers in bulk wholesale and then sell them retail for, you know, a penny more or whatever on the street. And at one point, he raised the prices of the newspapers that he was selling to the kids. And then they struck. And then he was brutal in his treatment of them, just like, you know, Rockefeller and Standard Oil would have been, you know, brutal toward his workers. And so it seemed to me that he showed his true colors in that regard when suddenly the working class rose up against him and he was crushing these little kids. You know, so it did seem to me like that contradiction right there showed where the deepest part of his psyche lay.
Yeah, I mean, I think when he turns on these little street urchins who are the backbone of his distribution and over, you know, a cents on the dollar, that shows a kind of a brutality and a harshness that does call into question, you know, his commitment to the working man. And I think you're right. I think that was a signal that maybe his crusading spirit wasn't entirely divorced from his money.
Right. Yeah. So at a certain point, his business interests, I know, began to overlap with his politics. And so how did that develop and what forms did it take? I know you mentioned the Spanish-American War, which he got involved in.
Well, his business, his politics, his personal life always were completely intermingled. There was no barrier between the news pages and his editorial positions. There was whenever he went off on one of his political campaigns, either for president or for mayor of New York and then governor, and he had many failed political campaigns, his newspapers were overwhelmingly used as a vehicle for promoting his politics. So, you know, in that way, he was not unlike what he did with his finances. He borrowed the money that was in the corporate accounts, he treated as his own. You know, when he raided the cookie jar, it was his cookie jar. There was no separation between the corporate bank accounts and his own spending. He merges things together, and it's all in the service of this powerful ego and this powerful drive to dominate and to influence events, and he's very successful at it.
Yeah, I think you mentioned all his political campaigns. I mean, it was pretty amazing. He ran for Congress, and I think won, and then he ran for president. A bunch of failed campaigns, the New York mayor, then New York governor, then mayor again, and he kept going after it and kept losing, which is unaccustomed for him, but he kept at it. Maybe they were all different reasons at different times and places, but overall, was there one key to his losing all these political campaigns where he was winning everything else in business and had such a high profile and great name recognition?
Well, when he ran for New York mayor, Tammany Hall, the machine in New York stole the election from him blatantly. Yeah. There were ballot boxes stuffed and floating out in the East River. He was just restless, and he had an unbelievable faith in his own rectitude and his own intelligence, and he went after things, and he would not be denied, and he would get crushed, and then he'd dust himself off and do it again. And I don't know for sure why he was such a glutton for punishment. He was a polarizing figure. He was immensely controversial during all of these campaigns. And he spoke his mind, and periodically his opponents, including Theodore Roosevelt, used the same tactics that he had used in his newspapers against him, in particular arguing famously that he had been responsible for inciting the assassination of President McKinley. Those kind of things ended up having traction and helped defeat him in some of his campaigns.
You know, later on, his personal life became more and more somewhat of a scandal. In particular, for decades, he carried on an affair with an actress named Marion Davies while remaining married to his faithful wife, with whom he had five children. And for a guest for Marion Davies, he built an extravagant castle in California called San Simeon, which some of our listeners might have visited. And did he eventually pull back from his obsessive focus on his papers and, you know, become just more a hedonist, more a party animal?
Well, you know, Marion was a famous Hollywood actress, and he lived openly with her for decades. He started San Simeon with Millicent, his wife, so it wasn't specifically built just for Marion. But pretty quickly, when they began to realize they had to live apart, then most of the time, Marion was at the castle. And he didn't ever, he loved Hollywood, and he loved bringing people from Hollywood out to San Simeon as this fantasy playground. And he loved doing that for Marion. And he was obsessive about decorating, building, and appointing the castle with a... He built a castle because he had a castle's worth of stuff to fill it with. But in the end, he never stepped back from his newspapers. I mean, he was writing and dictating editorials and notes until he died. Hmm. And I think that's one of the most admirable things about him. He was a tremendously focused and engaged citizen, whether you agreed with him or not, for his entire life. And he was a newspaperman till the day he died.
Yeah, you can't criticize his work ethic for sure. What cable news channel today, here's a funny question, would you compare Hearst's early papers with? I mean, I'm thinking maybe Fox News.
Well, sure. I mean, Fox is is maybe the most immediate example you'd think of, but... You know, he invented newsreels, or helped invent them and promote them, and he created something called an all-newsreel theater, which was updated all during the day with news that would get rushed in from wherever it was captured. And in some ways, that was a prototype of CNN. And his ability to sort of what we now in business terms call vertical integration or synergy, where he would take an idea from a newspaper and then put it in a magazine and then turn it into a newsreel and then make a feature film about it and then make a radio play about it. That's something that you see in all of media today, that ability to constantly reinvent and repackage stories, often with celebrity. Sometimes with a casual relationship to the truth, that I think is infected and influenced our entire media landscape for better and for worse.
Yeah, so I mean, you just talked about how much of today's journalism was influenced by his style and his approach. And so is that his legacy, or is there something more than that?
Well, I mean, I think Hearst is in the DNA of American media. I don't think we can pretend that we're not heirs in some profound way to what William Hearst created. And I think his legacy is a complicated one. I think on the one hand, he was a tremendous showman and brought energy and excitement and verve and often great writing and great design to the newspaper publishing. On the other side of the coin, he controlled maybe too much power in the 30s and used that power as a vicious anti-communist, maybe the most extreme anti-communist until Joseph McCarthy. And he went after ordinary people, and he was able to have more power than many elected representatives simply by the breadth of his newspaper empire. So I think there's a cautionary tale to Hearst that I think is something we need to be aware of in this current environment where single individual people, be it in the tech world or in the media landscape, have the ability to influence so much of our national discourse.
Well, it's been interesting, but we're going to have to leave it there. Again, the two-part PBS program called Citizen Hearst will air on American Experience Monday and Tuesday, September 27th and 28th, between 9 and 11 p.m. Eastern Time. Well, Stephen Ives, thank you so much for being on with us and talking about this fascinating and brilliant man.
Oh, well, thank you very much, Court. I've enjoyed talking to you.
Me too. Thanks to all of you for listening, and I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.